Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a James Beard-nominated chef is giving it all up. In the name of love.
And a former dominatrix moves to Tucson in search of tenderness. But first, politics on the Navajo Nation has turned rancorous as the tribe's president battles its legislature in a public debate that has lasted months. In the latest move, the legislature has opened an investigation into a deal the tribe entered into with a Mesa-based modular home builder, which then pulled out of the project. I'm joined now by Fronteras Desk senior editor Michelle Morisco to tell us more about how bad it's gotten and how we got here. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so this most recent controversy surrounds a company called Zenni Homes. They struck a deal with the Navajo government to build these modular homes, and it was kind of celebrated as a move to help solve the Navajo Nation's housing crisis. But most of those homes were not built. Their CEO says he spent millions of his own money and that of investors to build these custom homes on the Navajo Nation. So he then pulled out of the deal, closed down the factory. Michelle, tell us what happened.
Yeah, President Negrin, I should preface this, very famously said these homes were going to be built by Navajo, for Navajo, on Navajo.
Yeah.
This is what happened. Zenni Homes CEO Bob Worsley, and he's a former Arizona state senator, he said the company lost nearly $50 million to political interference. He also blamed contract breaches by the Navajo government and then subsequent delays. And then he said he made his decision after a $22 million contract reduction in early July. I reached him after the closure. This is what he said.
That it's very, very difficult to do business on Navajo until the executive and legislative branch make peace with each other. It's impossible.
Hmm. So now Navajo legislators want to know what happened to $24 million in federal ARPA funds that were allocated to the project. And they want to know how so many millions of dollars were spent. But in the end, only 18 homes were built. Meanwhile, 210 people lost their jobs. Tell us, Michelle, what is the future of this factory now?
So the factory had a 75-year lease for the former Navajo generating station site. That site, back in the, you know, up until it closed in 2022, it helped to employ about 700 people, and it helped to bring in about $40 million a year. Now, Zenni Home is looking to end that lease, and CEO Worsley alluded to a legal battle to recoup what he says were losses when the Zenni Home modular home project ended.
Okay, so potential legal battle there, but then there's this, also this battle between the legislature and the president that is continuing. President Negrin walked out of the State of the Navajo Nation address and has also walked out on one earlier this year. Tell us what's the latest here.
So in the latest, the legislative branch voted 15-1 to remove President Negrin's executive division directors who have not yet been confirmed. These are community and economic development directors. President Negrin has just a few days left to consider the council's resolution.
Okay. Michelle, what has the president had to say about all of this?
So President Negrin has been fairly embattled. You know, this is the second State of the Navajo Nation address that he's left. This time he's calling for peace. He's been posting photos with the vice president, Rochelle Montoya. He says he's reunited with her. If you recall, she has accused him late last year of sexual harassment. Those charges were eventually dropped the accusations. An investigation found that this hadn't occurred. Negrin says that they are working toward reunification. He's assigned her a tribal vehicle and staff again. He had previously removed her staff and had asked her to resign. And then he's also been reminding people that they have 18 months left in their term.
Yeah. Okay. So lots to watch for as this continues. That is Michel Morisco, KJZZ's Fronteras Desk senior editor, joining us from Flagstaff. Michel, thank you.
Thank you.
Arizona has seen an increase in the number of new HIV cases over the past 4 years. Since 2020, the state has gone from 665 new cases to 964 new cases last year. That follows a drop from 2018 to 2020 and relatively stable new case numbers dating back to 2014. To find out what may be behind these numbers, our co-host Mark Brody spoke with Dr. Ann Kalsa, a clinician at the Valleywise Health McDowell Clinic, which is an HIV specialty clinic. She's been in HIV casework since the late 1980s. And he asked what she makes of the rise in the number of new HIV cases since 2020.
We certainly have not seen a decrease or control of the rate of new HIV diagnoses in Arizona. We are one of the hotspot counties, so to speak, in the U.S. Part of it is parallel with the population increase in the county, but part of it is we have a young population with sexually active adults, and HIV continues to get transmitted. And the real problem is we haven't had adequate education and awareness in the community to be utilizing preventive tools that are now available. We have medications both as pills and shots that are up to 100% effective to prevent HIV acquisition. Of course, if someone is aware that they should be using it and has healthcare to get it and stays on the treatment or on the medication, then it's completely effective. This is a preventable illness. There's no reason for new cases to be occurring. But the other half of the equation in acquisition of HIV is folks who already have HIV need to stay on medication.
So is this just a matter, you mentioned the population is maybe a little younger. Is this maybe just folks who weren't alive during the 80s and early to mid 90s and maybe just aren't thinking about this the way that the people who were around then would?
That's a large part of it for sure. A lot of the younger people and the majority of people who are newly acquiring HIV are in their 20s and 30s. So yes, they weren't around back then and they're not hearing it in the news. And they're not seeing people dying of AIDS. So it's just, yeah, it's not in their mind.
Well, I also wonder if there's some measure here of like AIDS not being as much of a death sentence as it was. I mean, you have people like Magic Johnson, for example, very publicly announced when he acquired HIV and he's still going. So I wonder if it's maybe less of a concern for people than it used to be.
Yes, I think that is also the case. I think a lot of the younger folks who come in are not really upset or scared of dying. It's like, okay, yeah, I've had shots of penicillin for syphilis. I got syphilis as an STD. And okay, well, yeah, now I've got HIV, so give me a pill. And that's true for a large part. But what people don't know and what I now see as someone who's been treating this for decades is I've got an established patient panel personally, and they're aging along with me. And the process of aging with HIV is unfortunately not the same as aging without HIV, in that the virus is still present in the body. And the problem is, even though our medicines control active viral reproduction in the body, there is still virus present in the immune cells that are resting in our bone marrow and lymph nodes, etc. And when our immune system is called upon to treat a strep throat, to react to a strep throat or a flu infection or whatever, the virus that is contained within those cells is reproduced or replicated. And so for brief moments in time, you will actually have low levels of virus circulating in the blood. And those low levels of virus keep the immune system activated to help fight that virus, which that immune system activation causes chronic inflammation, which causes premature aging.
What is the way to bring these numbers down? I mean, can you do the same things that you did in the past this time?
So yes, there has been a goal now for more than a decade internationally to end the HIV epidemic. And one of the programs is to try to get everyone tested so they know if they have HIV or not. And if they do have HIV infection already, then get them on medication so that one, they don't die of AIDS, and two, they can't transmit it to others. So the goal has been, and was initially 90-90-90, now it's 95-95-95, which means get 95% of everyone tested, and everyone who already has HIV, get 95% of them tested so they know they have it, get 95% of them linked to care and on medication, and get 95% of those who are prescribed medication, get them stably coming back for clinic visits, and with 95% rate among that population of viral suppression. So that way, one, they're not again dying of AIDS, but two, they're virally suppressed and they're not going to transmit. The other half of that scenario is you start with the point of testing. Now, for those who test HIV negative, we have the same goals, get 95% of them linked to a prescriber to give them prevention. What's happened, unfortunately, recently is there are current as well as planned reductions in all of this funding. And so this whole program, three-pronged program to end the HIV epidemic, which means end new cases of HIV occurring, that whole program is being dismantled. And yeah, we're going to go backwards. We're going to roll the clock back a good couple of decades with what's going on right now, which is very unfortunate and very sad for all of us to see.
Well, what does all of this mean, do you think, for Maricopa County, especially, and maybe the rest of Arizona, with the numbers already going up before some of these programs and the funding are being cut?
So, unfortunately, we're already anticipating and planning for pending increases.
Do you have a sense of, like, by how much those rates might go up around here?
It really depends on the populations we're talking about and what their funding sources are. So for patients who currently don't have insurance and have been receiving prevention or treatment through this additional funding sources, that's at least 10% of the population, if not more. And then we also anticipate with pending Medicaid cuts, that may be up to a third of our patients. And so now, again, both either prevention or treatment. So you've got a third plus you've got 10% of patients with no insurance. So we could see 40% increases.
Well, it also kind of sounds like, in addition to more people acquiring HIV, it sounds like for at least some of those patients, if they don't have health insurance anymore, they're not going to have access to the kind of medication that keeps them from getting really sick and potentially dying.
You are totally correct. AIDS still absolutely can kill, just like the old days when we didn't have meds. And so if those two pieces fall apart, yeah, we may see sick people again. So, yeah, it's scary times in the future that we may potentially see again.
Dr. Ann Kalsa is a clinician at the Valleywise Health McDowell Clinic, which is an HIV specialty clinic.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why an award-winning chef decided to hang up his apron.
Do I really want to continue this relationship, you know? And after 23 years of it, I was like, I think I need to make a choice for myself. Mm-hmm. And that was a really tough decision. And I know a lot of people, pretty much no one saw that coming.
We'll hear more about Chef Donald Hawk's decision to leave the industry.
But first, when Margot Steinis was a teenager in New York City, she started working as a dominatrix. She spent long nights in a dungeon, being paid by men who wanted to be slapped, stomped on, and punched. Before long, Steinis sometimes found herself on the other side of the blows, the recipient of violent contact she purposely sought out. It was a time in her life when, as she puts it, she was, quote, using her body to experience and mediate the world. Steinis's work as a dominatrix is just one part of her new memoir, Brutalities. Eventually, she fell in love with a man who often struck her viciously and consensually as part of their intimacy. Their relationship was volatile, and when he finally left her, she was adrift, feeling a deep divide between her physical and emotional relationship with herself. Brutalities, which she started writing about 10 years ago after relocating to Tucson, tells the story of Steinis' long journey to weave these disparate parts of herself together, and the toll that process has taken on her body. As she acknowledges early in the book, it's a difficult story. When I spoke to her recently, I began by asking her to read a key passage.
I am a person who has hit and been hit under many convoluted and confusing circumstances. In bed, in ritual, in anger, in play, in fear, in desire, in boredom, in rage. Upon request, upon demand, without consent, in terror. I have struck and been struck by enough men, enough times, and enough ways to feel sure that there is nothing inherently bad or good about rough contact, that context and consent determine the value and consequence of such actions.
So that part, particularly that bit at the end about how there's nothing inherently bad or good about rough contact, that it's the context and consent that determine the value and consequence, that's difficult to sit with for somebody who has not navigated all the things that you've navigated. And there are many other sequences in the book that, as I'm sure anybody listening to this can imagine, are difficult to read. Early on in the book, you write that in your younger years, quote, nothing felt like much of anything, so I kept looking for whatever was more intense, more extreme. And you talk about doing that with drugs and alcohol to some degree, but it's ultimately violence that seems to end up delivering this sensation that you're craving. What felt different about violence than some of those other solutions you were pursuing as a younger person?
I mean, I think it had a lot of elements. I think that it was completely consuming physically and mentally at the same time, which was what I was looking for. Like, I wanted to be transported anywhere out of myself and the present moment. And I also, to be completely frank, found it easier to access. Like, drugs and alcohol cost money and were, you know, to like procure them, you know?
Right.
And this will probably surprise no one, but when you are a young, conventionally attractive woman in a city, you know, it takes no effort of procurement to find a man to do anything you want with you.
Part of what you were looking to escape was, as you put it in the book, the bondage of self. Do you remember when you first started feeling that as something you didn't want to keep company with?
Yeah, I mean, as long as I have had consciousness, and that language of bondage of self is from 12-step literature and culture. Okay. And I think when I first encountered that specific phrase, I was like, oh yes, that's the thing. Imagine something that makes you very uncomfortable, like, I don't know, sitting with like sandpaper in your pants or something. And then like, would you prefer not to feel like that? That's how I felt.
Got it. Well, one of the other yearnings that you seem to pursue throughout the book is, if I may, acceptance and approval. And in particular, one of the figures who you crave this acceptance and approval from, and please tell me if you would use different words, is this character, Dean. Dean is also somebody who administers a lot of the violence that you're seeking. Do you see a connection between that desire for the acceptance or approval and the violence?
Yes, 100%. Yes. I met this person when I was very young. He was much older than me and had a lot of power in the world. He was really magnetic, really charismatic. And I became infatuated with him, right? Like, this is pretty normal. Like, 18-year-old woman, like, gets a huge crush on a, you know, he was probably about 30 at the time, like, impressive older man. Right. Like, there's nothing so unique about that. But because he had these very specific predilections, I basically molded myself in his image, or in the image of what I thought he would desire. And I think in retrospect, because I was so young and my sexuality and my identity was so plastic, it really like formed me. Many of the things, the specific interactions I pursued were not, like the gratification I got from them wasn't within like my organism. The gratification was like knowing that I had made myself desirable or, you know, valuable to him in some way.
Hmm. One of the most searing sequences in the book is when you and Dean are living on a farm and things are not going well in your relationship. They haven't been for some time. He has come up with this plan of moving to Texas. You have tried to convince him to take you to Texas with him because you think that if he maybe will finally be happy there, and if he's happy there, you will be happy. And then he ends up leaving you behind. And I have the sense in that moment that there's a very different kind of violence to that interaction than the kind of violence you've told us about previously in the book that passes between you and Dean, where as much as he has physically harmed you previously, now he has really done this kind of act of emotional violence. What was different for you about that moment with him? Because it seems like that's a real pivot point for you in the story.
Yeah, I mean, that was arguably the biggest pivot point in my life. But what I will clarify is that in my own understanding of the damage that I sustained of, you know, my years with mm-hmm. Dean, the emotional psychological damage was 99% of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, emotional psychological harm.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that day where he left me was one of many such incidents, the most final. Mm-hmm. That was what made it notable, was that it was the end of our relationship.
Yeah.
And, you know, I now look back and I'm like, that was the beginning of my real life or my good life or my adult life or mm-hmm. the life that isn't harming me.
We'll have more of my conversation with Margot Steinis after the break. You're listening to The Show.
Good morning. It is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Before the break, we met Margot Steinis, whose new memoir, Brutalities, tells the story of her complicated relationship with violence, intimacy, and selfhood. She spent years of her life in a relationship with a man she calls Dean in the book, and that partnership caused Steinis an extreme amount of pain, both physical and emotional. But as Steinis told me, in a lot of ways, it also helped her.
I'm so grateful to him. It sounds like such a weird thing to say. Even though it's very easy to look at him as like, you know, the perpetrator, or like the villain of the story. And some of that is absolutely true. It also was like a really shared responsibility in the chaos and the dysfunction and the continuation of it.
Yes. Well, in the vein of him being a nuanced character, as you were just saying, one of the things he does is introduce you to welding. And you end up pursuing a career as a welder. And it seems like that experience, even though it does not end up lasting, provides you with some sort of unexpected answers to a lot of these questions that you've been pursuing since you were very young. Is that a fair framing?
Absolutely. I think it allowed me a bridge between like one way of relating to men and another that we're not otherwise going to be able to be connected.
Can I ask you more about that, the relating to men piece of it? Because something that, mm-hmm. that struck me in that sequence is you go to such great lengths as you begin to work professionally as a welder and work amongst men. You write about doing all this work in a physical sense in terms of how you dress and present yourself to defeminize mm-hmm. yourself. And it was such a moving passage because we're reading about you, who at that point in the book has already been through so much pain and so much attempt to free yourself from, as we've been talking about, this bondage of self. And there seems to be a way in which welding is offering this new avenue, but you still, at least as I read it, have to do some measure of kind of denying your physical reality.
I think that after being so sexualized at a young age and only having performed sexualized labor, I wanted to know how I would do in the world if I wasn't using the currency of people trying to f*** me. Like, it was that simple. Because
right.
everything I had ever, you know, gotten or achieved or was easy or anything, I was like, oh, it was because, like, that man wanted something from me. That man wanted something from me. That man wanted something from me. So when I moved into this new space that had, you know, nothing to do with sexuality, I didn't want to like bring that residue with me and kind of like taint it is how I felt at the time.
Right. Well, so the next phase of the story has you living in, I think you're living in Hawaii at this point. Mm-hmm. You're still, if I'm not mistaken, doing metalwork, but you also start doing distance running. And you write about pushing yourself to just extraordinary levels of physical exhaustion and harm. Like you talk about doing this, like all this damage to your heels. And that felt like another interesting shift in the book to me as well, because now there is still, in a way, this violence being perpetrated on your physical being, but now it's you doing it to yourself.
Yeah.
Did it still feel like a dynamic with craving that sort of obliterating sensation?
It was very much about the exact same thing, but I had almost zero self-awareness of it.
Okay.
And it really wasn't until I started writing my book some years later that it, you know, as sometimes the most obvious things will dawn on a person, I was like, oh, I've been doing the same thing the whole time. Or like, perhaps more accurately, I've been seeking the same thing, but in these like wildly disparate contexts that, you know, on their face have nothing to do with each other. I mean, I spent, you know, however many years I was with Dean, like 15 years, being like, how dare he treat me like this, even though I continued to pursue that treatment. And then, you know, in metalwork, it was very easy to be like, well, the men treat me poorly, which, you know,
right,
not invariably, but like that was very true. But then with athletics, I was like, oh, I'm the only one here, you know, and it like kind of blew through a lot of denial that I hadn't even realized I was engaging in.
Huh. Well, so tell me then about this scene where you're, I think you're at a coffee shop and you write about how all of a sudden you recognize how much your life matters to you after so many years of it not mattering to you, and that it's so overwhelming that your breath catches.
It wasn't actually one particular moment. It was a phenomenon that started happening to me regularly.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. Around when I moved to Arizona for grad school.
When it started to happen, did you tie it to some deeper shift in your presence in the world?
No, I was completely baffled by it. Like I was, okay. And I was, at the time I was like, I think I was like 35. I was like, is this menopause? Is that what's happening to me? And like, it wasn't, because now I know what that feels like. And you know, it was moving to Arizona for grad school was a very special time in my life, because it was really the first time ever that I had done something that wasn't reactive, that was for me. It wasn't for anyone else. Like I didn't know anyone when I moved here. I moved here alone. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't running from anything. I was like running towards something, and I had never had that experience before.
Yeah. Well, I know one of the other things that happens in Arizona is that you meet this character who in the book you call N, who you end up having a kid with. And a lot of the book is a chronicle of your relationship with him, which is so warm and nurturing and caring and the exact opposite of all the other dynamics that we've been talking about so far. How much of these feelings that you associate with Arizona do you associate with N?
A lot of them, but I'm very careful to remember the brief time when I came here before I met him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I came here to do an MFA. I was here for my writing.
Yeah.
And for no other reason. And for the first time in my life, when I met people and, you know, because I was going to these like orientations and stuff, and they were like, oh, like, you know, who are you? What do you do? Whatever. I allowed myself to be like, I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. And I had been writing for a long time, but I had never allowed myself to feel like a real writer. And so I think like, yes, a lot of the goodness that I felt moving here has to do with my relationship and my partner and his inherent goodness and, you know, all of the kindness and warmth and excitement and that stuff between us. But also like, I would not have been available or probably even interested in that if I hadn't arrived at my own sense of freedom and purpose.
Right. I'm so struck by the way you just put that, Margot, because you're saying this was the first time that you kind of stood proudly and said, I am a writer, which is the opposite of the bondage of self. That's standing so proudly in selfhood.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think of the years I spent in Hawaii and when I first moved here as kind of like my adolescence in some way. Like I have just been on a really slow path to maturity. Yeah. And now at 42, I'm like, okay, I have the emotional skills and tools of an 18-year-old. Fantastic. That's more than I've had previously.
Well, in closing, I would like to ask you to read one more of my favorite passages from the book.
I regret none of the seeking I did, not one strike, not one moment. I know in a deep, true place that I needed all those blows to the face, all those not quite right moments to finally understand the tremendous power of gentle love.
Well, Margot Steines is a writer, the author of the book Brutalities. Margot, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. If you have watched the hit show The Bear, you know that restaurant kitchens can be stressful places. The pressure is high, the hours are long, and perfection is key. But our next guest this morning was good at it. Really good at it. Chef Donald Hawk has been nominated for multiple James Beard Awards. His work at Phoenix Destination Valentine has been recognized by Esquire and the New York Times. And he's been named Phoenix's best chef in more ways than one. In many ways, he was at the top of his game. But then he left. After 23 years in the industry, Chef Hawk announced his retirement earlier this summer. He picked up his life, moved to Las Vegas with his partner, and started a new career in wildlife biology, of all things. He told me he did it for his relationship, after seeing firsthand just how difficult it can be to keep one going in the restaurant industry.
Relationships are hard in the industry. They always have, and they always will be, you know, because it's just, there's so much time that's required, and you know, that just comes with the territory.
Yeah.
And so when I decided to move, I was thinking if I took another job in the industry, it would have been the same thing all over again. Because for me, it's all or nothing. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to think, oh, what am I going to do? And she suggested that. And then I went for it.
So I'll ask you in a moment about how it's going, but let me ask you first about your decision to leave, right? Like you've done so well at Valentine. You've turned this into this very respected place. You've been a James Beard semifinalist multiple times here. I mean, you were really on a roll. Why leave now?
I think it was just time for me. I was just thinking like, oh, I really want to continue this relationship, you know, and after 23 years of it, I was like, I think I need to make a choice for myself. Mm-hmm. And that was a really tough, really tough decision. And I know a lot of people, pretty much no one saw that coming. Everyone was a little shocked for sure. And yeah, I made the choice for myself.
Yeah. Do you miss it already? It's only been a little bit of time here, but what do you miss?
You know, I miss the people for sure. Do I miss standing in hot kitchens for so many hours a day, you know, with like the amount of stress it comes with every day? I'm not missing that entirely right now. It's a little bit of a break. And I really, you know, I really loved that industry, but I think it was time I needed a break.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like this is something that happens in the restaurant world at some point for a lot of people, a lot of people who have been as successful as you. I mean, restaurants are stressful. They're physically demanding. It's a high risk, high reward industry is how I would describe it. I mean, talk a little bit about your experience in it and I guess being able to make the leap to pull yourself out of that.
Getting to cook food, getting to create things, getting to make people happy it's a really incredible thing, you know, inviting people almost into like our version of our home and taking care of them was very fulfilling. Mm-hmm. So many of my friends don't have careers that are fulfilling to them. And they always are like wanting more. And for me, it was like, I really loved every moment of that industry. I'd probably do it again in a heartbeat. Yeah, I'd change some things, but I would go back again.
So it must have been something really great to pull you away from something you love that much.
Yeah. A lot of people who have been in this for 20 years can understand this. COVID kind of shook things up for people. But I've had a lot of friends, you know, when they actually got to spend time at home with their partner. And so often that was like way more time than they've ever spent. And so many people told me that their partner was like, you know what, this is really nice that you're getting to spend time at home.
Right.
Because it just didn't happen very much. You'd get like a Monday off, or I could give you like 6 hours here, you know, 6 hours here. And I told my partner, like, you know, I can find a job anywhere. That I'm not worried about, but I can't find someone like you. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was after going through relationships, I went through, not to talk about too much, I went through a divorce in this industry, you know, that's really tough. And I kind of changed the way I'm like, you know what, maybe I need to take time and put a little more into that side.
And a lucky lady you're with there now.
Fortunate, yeah, very fortunate.
So Valentine, as I kind of alluded to, has become a really important place in the Phoenix dining scene, probably because of what you're talking about and because of the, you know, national attention that you've received there. You've worked with a lot of the best chefs in the Valley over the course of your career, I know, from Bernie Cantak to Chris Bianco. I wonder, like, looking at the Phoenix restaurant scene over a couple of decades, how far do you think it's come? How far do you think it still has to go?
It's coming up a lot. I remember going to, you know, Bianco when I was younger and seeing what he was doing. And then the scene kind of sat idle. And I remember going one of the first weeks F&B restaurant opened, sitting at the counter and watching Charlene cook, seeing what she did. And then seeing Renee win a Beard Award last year, which was really incredible. And then seeing our friends from Lam Long Sunny win it is just showing you that Arizona is really, really starting to come up. We're not as big of a slouch as we used to be. I guess people have said we're a slouch, but there's always been people here trying to do things. It's now that there's actually more of a spotlight on Phoenix is a pretty, pretty incredible thing. I mean, it's 2 years in a row. We've had a Beard Award in the state. We've had the past 4 years. Someone's gotten Best New Restaurant from Esquire. Or Bon Appetit, you know, LT, you know, got Food and Wine Best New Chef. That's huge for the region.
Yeah.
You know, our friends Isaac and Courtney at Kid Sister really pushing a restaurant that hasn't really ever been seen in Arizona. I mean, that's really incredible. And just to see that happening in the state after so many years of us just everyone just thinking we're just a cactus town and a steakhouse town.
Yeah. Like I mentioned, you have been, I think it's twice, a semifinalist for a James Beard Award, but you didn't win the top award, at least.
That's okay.
Well, is it? I mean, do you regret that? Was it hard to step away from your career knowing that you might have gotten to that level at some point here?
I wasn't really ever thinking I would have won that. Not to say it couldn't have happened, but for me, it was just like, it's nice to be invited to the party. Yeah, it's very nice to have your name on that list, especially with people you really look up to, you know? That's a really, really special feeling. You can't really beat that. Mm-hmm. But it's not like I was cooking to win awards. I was just cooking food to be happy. If you cook food just to win awards, I don't think your cuisine's going to be as good as you think it's going to be.
Yeah. Okay, so you're leaving Valentine, I know, in good hands to your sous chef. But tell me a little bit about what's next for you? You're in this new industry in Vegas. You're trying to feel that out. Is it a bit of a culture shock?
Yeah, it's 100% a bit of a culture shock. My days are a little bit different than what they used to be. I still wake up early. I still get ready for work. I still put in my time every day. And then I go home and relax. But it's gonna take a second to kind of get used to that so I can just kind of like sit still, relax. Don't think I have to do everything all at once. It's a big thing.
Are you cooking for yourself at home?
No. For the first time in my life, I have to meal prep.
Right.
Which seems so exhausting. I just never have cooked at home. I never had time. And if I cooked at home, it wasn't like what people thought chefs eat at home.
Right.
Or anything like that.
It never is. So you think you'll ever go back to restaurants, or is this it for you?
I mean, never say never, but for right now, I just want to see how far this career takes me.
Okay. Well, if you do come back to Phoenix. That is Donald Hawk, the former chef of Valentine, multiple James Beard nominee. Donald, thank you so much for coming on and good luck.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tempe writer, performer, and storyteller Kim Porter has always been a stickler for rules. So when her high school best friend did nothing but break the rules, well, you can imagine what happened. And if you can't, Porter's going to tell you in the next installment of our Soapbox series on the topic, misbehaving.
When I was 20, I got in a huge fight with my best friend Sean when I found out he'd hooked up with another one of my boyfriends. So I vowed to never, ever speak to him again. But a few weeks later, Sean's mom, Norma, died suddenly, and I was torn. I'd met Sean in high school when we were riding the same school bus to a speech tournament. We'd pulled over at a gas station, and through the window, Sean started oinking at a chubby lady pumping gas. Because I'm a stickler for proper decorum, I said, "You're only making yourself look bad." And Sean, who never met a boundary he didn't test, replied, "Should we be best friends?" We had a lot in common, but we differed fundamentally on the question of misbehaving. Sean told me that as a Taurus, I was the most rule-obsessed sign of the zodiac, and as a Sagittarius, he was the most lawless. Nonetheless, we were best friends until a few weeks ago. Then his mom died. I was torn. On the one hand, I really wanted to do the right thing, thereby proving to Sean that I was a better person than him. On the other hand, proving I was a better person than him didn't seem like the right thing to do under the circumstances. I waffled for days until my mom showed me Norma's obituary in the paper, which said there was going to be a viewing that night. "Go," she said. "It's the right thing to do." By the time I arrived at the funeral home, the family had already gone. It was just me and the funeral director. He led me to a room and he said, "And when you're done, rest in chair." And he pointed to a wing-back chair next to a table with a bouquet and a book. "Thanks," I said. "Rest in chair? Does he think I'll faint or something? Maybe he's right." I braced myself, but when I saw Norma in her coffin, I did not faint. After I paid my respects, I turned to go, but the man stopped me. "Please, rest in chair." I'm okay. Thanks, though. "For the family, please, rest in chair." "Okay, thanks," I said, and I sat. Why was this man making me rest in this chair? And how on earth is this for the family? Couldn't he see I was fine? Does he know something I don't know? Like, are some people overcome with emotion as they're driving away? I tried to do the right thing, to rest, but the man just stood there, head tilted, eyebrows raised, staring at me. Minutes passed. In desperation, I started faking it. I stretched. I sniffed the bouquet, and I picked up the book whose title I noticed was Registry. Then I heard it. "Register. Rest in chair." "Oh," I said. "Register?" "Yes, please." The man was right. On the way home, I was overcome with emotion, mortification. And I thought, you know who would really love this story? Sean. So I called him, and we were friends again, until he hooked up with my new boyfriend.
That was Kim Porter. You can hear more Soapbox essays at kjzz.org. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.